space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. My woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch cats fish from dusk till dawn. We make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Those Muslim old boys raised on shotguns. We say grace, we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. We came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. We can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. Grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, 'cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. California.
California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. And we can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Buddy, my grandfather used to say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's some wise words. But anyway, fuel crisis, yeah. Fuel crisis is a choice, man. And women. So, modern day society talk about all this dinosaur fuel, this so-called fossil fuel, and how we got limits of it, you know, and we gotta go over there and buy oil from somebody else, and then they always talk about energy independence and fracking and all this other craziness, you know. Things you want to abuse nature to try to get oil up out of the ground. The craziest thing about it is, it's been, said for a long time, way back in the old days, whenever, they used to be moonshiners, that the moonshiners would actually fill their fuel tanks up with alcohol. And that way, if the revenue got behind them, all they had to do was outrun them until the tank was empty and there wasn't no evidence. Of course, back in them days, I suppose, evading the law, man, and, speed limits probably weren't a whole lot, strict, so to speak. So they might have been able to get by with it back in the day, but I don't know how they'd fare today running out of gas and then getting caught, because then you'd be felony eluding or something like that. But nonetheless, the stories were told that they were used to be able to run their doggone cars off of grain alcohol, and so that kind of, I guess some people would call it an urban legend, others would call it a myth, and those who understood how it all functions would realize that it's actually a true thing. You really can run your car off of alcohol. Matter of fact, when you go to the fuel station nowadays, you'll see a percentage of ethanol in your gasoline. By the way, you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, just jump over there to the superchat.html or shazizradio.com. And let's have some fun and talk about alternative fuel sources, alternative energies and such. As well, if you're over there, don't forget to check out Wolf Spirit Radio. And you can scroll down at the bottom of the chat room there and you'll see a link for People for People Radio Network. Go over there and join that chat room. Tell them we said hi. So, with that said, let's get into this deal. So, there's lots of ways to make alcohol. I actually threw a video inside the doggone chat room. Takes you step by step how to make alcohol. Now, I'm not advocating anybody go out there and make alcohol, but to each his own, whatever. It's a really simple process. And, let's say you live in an area where there's lots of berries, any fruit that has sugar in it, anything that has sugar in it can be used to make alcohol. That's not even getting into the biodiesel aspect of things. And the modern day engines out here, as you will hear pretty soon, will actually run on it. And it surprised me that Mythbusters actually kind of halfway... give it a little bit, but then again, they finally had to admit that, yeah, it actually will run your doggone car. And had they had understanding in the beginning, this guy's out there that make these little nifty little racing go-karts, and you have to understand that when you put that fuel in, because of the type of fuel, you're either going to have to run it on a choke, a little bit of a choke going on there so that you can get the fuel-air mixture ratio right, or you're going to have to change the jets inside the carburetor system. And so the first couple things, I'm going to go ahead and play this little podcast from the Mythbusters, but the first thing that they were running this into a regular carbureted system and then into a little bit later model with a fuel-injected system, same kind of concept. You have to understand that fuel-to-air ratio. And they could have known before they ever even done that, because it's supposed to be science, guys, but they should have known before they ever even tried it that what the results was actually going to be, and that they could actually run it on modern-day equipment as well. So, that's all for the TV, I guess. But nonetheless, I'm going to go ahead and play this one little part, let you hear a bit of it.
We've got a myth that's really common. I mean, it's been on Back to the Future, Lawless, Dukes of Hazzard.
And that is that you can run a car on nothing but moonshine without any modifications, and it'll be totally fine.
What I have here is traditional moonshine. Now, this is what we're going to be using to fuel our cars. Now, this particular moonshine is about 192 proof, which means it's about 96% ethanol.
There goes the old spoon.
Now, ethanol is the fuel that race cars use, so there is a chance that this could work. However, our cars are far from race cars. They're not tuned up for this kind of fuel. So is this going to be an effective fuel? We're about to find out.
First, a cruise on the booze. It's Tori's 70s car.
I'm driving a 73 vehicle, which, by the way, has a carburetor. Now, a carburetor's job is to mix the fuel and the air together so that the engine runs smoothly. Now, if there's not enough fuel and too much air, the vehicle is going to be running lean, which means it might not run at all. Here we go. This is moonshine in a carbureted car in 3, 2, 1.
Oh my god, here we go.
I think this thing is running on moonshine and a prayer.
I think it's just running on a prayer at this moment.
Is that stalled? I think it's stalled.
It's stalled. Oh, started again.
I'm not getting away from any cop if I'm driving that car on the moonshine.
So, after less than one complete lap...
Man! Moonshine in a carbureted car? Not the best gas.
It's clear the carburetor can't handle the 4% water in the hooch.
3, 2, 1.
Woo! That was a good start.
But could a different way of dispersing fuel give the 90s car the edge?
Now, these 90s-era cars are fuel-injected, which means that the fuel is pumped through a tiny nozzle at high pressure, and that atomizes the gas immediately.
All right, here comes acceleration test. No worries.
That's one lap down.
Better have more shot than that one.
Two to go.
Almost feeling like it might die.
In trouble with the idle?
This is not good. Come on.
Oh, I hear a bit of stuttering in the engine. They seem to be losing a little bit of acceleration.
Yep, it seems the moonshine isn't compatible with a fuel-injected 90s car.
At first, it was going really, really well, but as the test went on, it started to hesitate from a stop. It was jerking while it was idling. We had a loss of power.
So although the 70s car and the 90s car struggled with the white whiskey, will the modern car have a taste for moonshine?
That clears your sinuses. All right, so I'm driving the 2013 car. I'm sort of glass half full and half empty on this one. I mean, it's a new car, so it's not flex fuel, but it does have a sophisticated computer that might be able to recognize an alternative fuel. But moonshine, being ethanol, burns a lot hotter than gasoline. It might just burn out the engine altogether. In 3, 2, 1...
It's not starting.
Come on, give it a second.
Yes!
Okay. Here we go, jump in!
Good luck!
Although it was slow to start, the 2013 is off and most definitely running.
It feels a little off, but not in a bad way.
So far, I don't hear any clunking like, you know, when you have the wrong kind of fuel in there. This car's taking it all in stride.
I can't believe this is not actually bad. I'm shocked.
So, after completing 3 almost perfect laps, it's clear the unmodified modern car and its computer can handle the hard stuff.
So this one's confirmed. You can run a car on moonshine.
That is so bizarre.
All right, so, well, you know, as much as I don't really like the Mythbusters because of some of their shenanigans, hey, they just confirmed that we don't have a fuel crisis, and we never had a fuel crisis. So, I'm going to play another little one. This guy's running his lawnmower off of it.
Hi, Tubes. Got something pretty interesting here for you today. We're out here in the shed, and I got this old lawnmower here. And I wanted to do a test today. I wanted to answer a question that I've had for quite some time. And it's something we've always been asking, but never actually tried out. And that question is... can you run an engine on Everclear? So I got this bottle of Everclear here, and I can't believe somebody would actually drink this stuff. The label is highly amusing in my opinion. You got the corn on there, obviously it's grain alcohol, and it says, caution, extremely flammable, handle with care. Warning, double exclamation point, overconsumption may endanger your health. So the fact that people want to drink this, why that is kind of beyond me. It says not intended for consumption unless mixed with non-alcoholic beverage. Okay, so you're not supposed to take shots of this, but people do anyway. I think it'll run because it's 190 proof, and that means it's 95% alcohol by volume. So I'm pretty sure it'll run on it, but I don't really know what'll happen. My expectation is that I'll have to turn the choke up because alcohol requires a richer mixture in order to burn the stoichiometric ratio. So that's my prediction. I think it will run, but I'll have to keep the choke on. I definitely wouldn't I wouldn't recommend trying this at home, especially if it's on anything good. I mean, this lawnmower here is probably worth about $25, but I mean, I don't know if this is going to work or not, but, you know, even if it does work, just because it works good for me doesn't mean it'll work good for you. So don't try this at home, kiddies.
All right, now what I'm about to do here is I'm going to flip the switch here, and I just shut the fuel off to the engine. So that way, what'll happen is it'll suck up all the gas out of the fuel line and out of the carburetor bowl and out of the fuel filter, and that way there'll be absolutely no gasoline inside the system. And that way when you hook up the auxiliary tank with the Everclear in it, it'll be running on pure Everclear, and we won't have to worry about that, any gas getting mixed in with it.
Gas. Alright, so as you can see here, our old gas tank is completely disconnected. Hose just runs up along there, and so that's not hooked to anything. And so now we're hooked up to our liquor tank here. It's just an old Briggs & Stratton tank I had laying around. And as you can see here, I'll turn my light on. That tank is bone dry. There's nothing inside there right now. Not water, not gasoline, no alcohol, nothing. So we're starting out with a good test here.
Alright. Fill her up.
Say that's enough. Alright, now I haven't messed with the controls at all since it shut down after we ran the gas out of it, so it should be warmed up. And I don't think I'll need the choke. I'm going to leave the throttle where it was at. It'll probably just take a couple pulls to get the fuel pumped back up into the carburetor. Step back from this thing a little bit because I don't know how well it can hear me when I'm right up next to it, but as you saw that, I had to tune it up a little bit. As I expected, it needed a little bit of choke to run. It's only a little bit though. If you give it too much choke, it also won't run, so it seems like if I wanted to do this permanently, I wouldn't need to change the jets even. Just run it with a little choke on, but let's see how it runs around the yard. I think we're out of alcohol. Well, at first I thought it was bogging down because of the load, but as it turns out, looks like the tank's empty. I only put a little bit in, and I ran it around the yard a little bit to warm it up first. Alright, that's enough. Thank you. I gotta say, I thought it would run, but I had no expectation that that bull bar would run this good on that bottle of alcohol. That's pretty incredible. You can smell it in the exhaust, too. You can definitely tell, like, you can smell that bottle. It's like a real, almost like a sweet smell. You can smell it in the exhaust when it's burning, too. A little bit different from gasoline. We just ran out of alcohol again. I'm not surprised because I keep only putting a little bit in at a time. What I should really do is get some gasoline and run it and see how long it takes to burn a specified amount, and then run the Everclear and see if the level of consumption is higher or lower. I would expect it to be higher because I'm pretty sure there's a lower energy content per unit of grain alcohol as opposed to gasoline. That's why, like, E85 fuel, if you're running ethanol in your car, you can't go as far on the tank. The economy's worse.
Exceedingly successful, far more successful than I expected it to be. Like I said, I thought it would putt along a little bit. That would be it. I had no idea it would run that good. But there you have it, running an engine on Everclear. Yes, it can be done. So that'll be interesting. If I had more daylight out, it's just about dark now. Otherwise, I'd try and run it on something else. Maybe one of the mini bikes. We'll pull them out and have some Everclear races or something like that. I don't know, but. Anyway, hope you enjoyed the video. We'll see you later, Tubes.
So, you heard it there. I'm trying to type a message here. Sorry about that. there we go. That's bad for radio. okay. So you heard it. You heard there's a dude running his lawnmower on basically alcohol. See, the whole doggone thing here is this. Worst case scenario, you always got fuel for all these old engines. If you understand how these engines actually function, I actually posted a link inside the chat room, survivalmanual.com, gas to alcohol conversion, PHP. Anyway, it basically tells you how to, modify an old existing, say, Briggs & Stratton or something like that to run on alcohol. And pretty much the same concept would work for any engine out there. So, hey, he's back. Yay! All right, so we got that resolved. Do-do-do-do. Put a smiley face in there. All right, so, anyway... Any engine out there could be specifically engineered to run off of just about any type of fuel, any carbon-based fuel, or, you know, any type of sugar and corn and all that kind of stuff can be turned into a fuel source. And, of course, we went into water as a fuel as well. So, if you had to listen to part of that deal, they said there was like 4% water in that alcohol. I think it was on the Mythbusters one that said that there was a bit of water in there. Of course, there's water, and there's water in gasoline. But, nonetheless, that water is still being used as fuel. And if it's properly engineered, you could design an engine to run specifically on water alone. But not either way, it still shows that there's not a fuel crisis. There's no reason to be over there, fighting with people over oil resources and stuff like that, or tearing up the ground in order to get fuel. We got all kinds of alternative fuels. Everything from using old grass clippings, turning them into biodiesels or biodiesel fuel, or even taking, old tree limbs and stuff and making wood gasifiers. Heck, they did it back in, I think it was World War I or World War II, when they ran low on fuel. They had big giant wood gasifiers in the back of their trucks and jeeps and stuff, and they were still able to run those vehicles. So once you have an understanding of how that engine actually works, then, you know, you can modify all different types of fuels out there. But the reason why I wanted to bring this to the table was that if a worst case scenario happened and you couldn't get fuel for your engines and you knew a few tricks ahead of time, maybe even went ahead and made you a separate carburetor, all you'd have to do is swap out the carburetor, and then all you'd have to do is from that point on is you know, switch out types of fuels that you can make the fuel in your own home. I'm not going to play that particular podcast, but I did post the video link in there of basically how to make alcohol. And once again, I'm not advocating anybody go out and make alcohol. In some, most places, it's illegal, and I can give you a few reasons probably why. One of which is that they sure don't want everybody running around on a alcohol burning vehicle when they want to sell you gasoline. So there's one other one here that I want to play. But like I said, there's a, it gives you the recipe on how to make alcohol right there at your house. And so if you write that recipe down and all the notes on it, and apocalypse happens and you can't get no fuel from the fuel stations, at least you have an alternative fuel source for your internal combustion engines. And if you pre-plan ahead of time, it'll be a lot easier on you. But if you're running, let's say you're running alcohol, you're making your own doggone alcohol, and you're using it in your generator system at home, and with a few modifications, you can actually compensate for any extra heat that might be generated or whatever, because they run pretty good. But nonetheless, you could use the take the heat away from free booze. Yeah, you heard me right, brother. It's that simple. There's probably berry trees all over the place. You could get you some any type of fruit that has sugar in it, and if you live next to a sugar cane field, or you know, even corn for that matter, there's lots of ways to make all kinds of booze out there. But we're talking about using it for fuel because, yeah, it's clean burning fuel. Not to mention you could use it to cook on. Instead of using like propane, you could put a little bit of pressure to it and run the vapors up through a custom built system and have a cook stove where you could use the same exact type of fuel. So, you know, and I bet I ain't never tried it, probably wouldn't try it, but I bet this stuff would probably even work on a Coleman lantern or something like that if it was slightly modified for safety purposes. Nonetheless, that last one I played was straight off the store shelf, fuel right off the store shelf running his lawnmower. All right, and so with that said, that's probably one reason why the old revenuers don't want you making home-brewed alcohol, because it could interfere with the, what do they call that doggone, the petrol dollar, you know, the fuel dollar. Instead of you being backed by gold, now your money's backed by oil. So you got to go over there and negotiate with a bunch of crazy people to get you some doggone oil. Then they can bring the price up or down, whatever they want. So they're over there fighting over oil. They're fighting over where to put a fuel line, a gas line, a natural gas pipeline. That's another thing there. Natural gas, it's something that nature produces all the time. And so you can run vehicles on natural gas. So where in the heck is the fuel crisis? You know, there was way back in the 70s, they call it the Arab oil embargo, and they were saying that this caused a lot of problems and people couldn't get fuel and that kind of stuff. Caused, you know, a ruckus. Way back then they had this knowledge that they could actually run the doggone vehicles on alternative fuels. So if you're running your doggone your generator on alcohol that you're making, number one, it's free fuel. Now, I don't recommend that you drink it because you wake up next morning with a headache. But other than that, you got to be careful anyway. Some people, I don't know what the heck they're thinking when they drink that grain alcohol. That stuff will kill you, man. Jeez. Anyway, either way, it's going to keep that those cylinders inside that head of your engine clean. Plus, you know, it's free fuel. And if you know how to make it, you know, it's that simple. But Now you got electricity. You could tap into the water jacket of it if you got a water jacket on the gasoline engine and use that for heating purposes in your house. And from the generator portion of it, you get your electricity. So in worst case scenario, you got heat, you got electricity, and free fuel to boot, because you already knew how to make it ahead of time. So I'm going to play this one right here. This guy right here is going to run an old Dodge Stratus off of his.
Recently I got a new car, and my old car is going to the junkyard. So I was wondering if it would run on moonshine without any modifications whatsoever to the engine. So I went out and I got a little bit of moonshine. Moonshine is generally about 190 proof. Straight out of the still, which is about 95% alcohol and about 5% water. This high test hooch, however, is about 99.95% alcohol, because it's against the law to make moonshine. So what I did was I went out and I got straight methanol. Now the first question I had was whether or not the methanol and the gasoline would mix together. There's just a little tiny bit of gasoline left in the tank, and I thought, you know, maybe they would stay separated when I poured this into the tank. So what I did was I went and I put a little bit of alcohol in this beaker and a little bit of gasoline, and as you can see, they mix together beautifully. They're both hydrocarbons, so it's not too surprising that they are completely homogeneous. The next thing I want to do is a burn test. I'm going to take a little bit of alcohol and a little bit of gasoline, and we're going to light them on fire and see what happens. I have here a little bit of gasoline in this beaker. Gasoline burns at about 1950 degrees Celsius. Now, I have also here a little bit of that methanol. This burns at about 1920 degrees Celsius, which is a little bit less, but not a lot. Let's move this out of the way so we don't light everything in the world on fire. And now let's light that on fire. Well, it's burning and you can't even see the flame. I thought it was out. So as you can see, it burns a lot cleaner than gasoline. So after our burn test, you can see that the gasoline container is just covered with soot. It was only burning for like a few seconds, and you can see the discoloration in the glass. Compared to the alcohol, here, you can see that there's absolutely no soot whatsoever. The alcohol burned much, much cleaner than the gasoline did. So this is like what's coming out of the tailpipe here. I mean, you can see all of the pollutants that would be coming out of your tailpipe as compared to the alcohol. None whatsoever. I mean, I'm sure there's some, but none that you can see on the glass.
One of the keys that he just said right there is when you look at the two beakers of glass where he burnt the gasoline in one and the he's using methanol in the other, it's how clean that glass was. You got carbon soot up here on the doggone gasoline one, where the other one was nice and clean, which... You'd think that in the, I guess the government's mind, if you wanted to run a fuel that was really clean burning, that would probably be the choice there if you're so worried about so-called carbon emissions, which we all know how I feel about that as well.
So here's the old girl herself. It's a Dodge Stratus. She has 363,000 some odd miles on her. I was hoping to drive her to the moon and back. I got there and I went around and I'm on my way back. That's 477,000 miles round trip, but I didn't quite make it. She's got to go to the junkyard. You can see that the engine is just the straight old engine that was in it, original, very few parts. Nothing added for this methanol experiment. It's just the straight up engine. It's got very little oil in it, I would imagine, because I didn't... I haven't checked it in years. I'm going to just put this into the tank. There's a slight bit of gasoline in the tank right now. It's probably, I'd say, much less than a gallon, probably. It's way down on E. The gas light is on. So it's going to start on the gas that's in the fuel lines right now and should run just fine. I don't know if we'll know when the methanol hits But if we let it run long enough, it's certainly going to start running on the methanol. It's going to be a mixture of methanol and gasoline, but it's going to be very, very little gasoline. For all intents and purposes, it's straight methanol. Okay, here we go. Okay, so now it's running on a little bit of gasoline that's in it. About a half tank of gas now. Where before I had, it was on E, the gas light was on. So far so good. Right now I would say that the worst case scenario is that we're driving on about 90% alcohol. Well, that's not true. Let's say there was a gallon in the car, right? So that puts us at about 80% alcohol. This is just a regular car. It's not been designed to run on flex fuel. It's not a flex fuel vehicle. It's not made for E85 gasoline. But here we are driving down the street with at least 80% alcohol. I notice no difference right now in the way the car is driving. The idle is the same. Everything seems exactly the same. So we're going to drive it around until we use up some of this gasoline, and we'll see. Here we are. This is a 2005 Dodge Stratus, and we're running on alcohol, almost completely 100% alcohol, at least 80% alcohol, and we're having no problems. There's no difference in the way the car functions. I mean, the car never functioned really well as it was, but I turned it off yesterday. It had very little gasoline. We turned it on today with mostly alcohol in it, and it's running just beautifully. Maybe it's going to eat up the rubber O-rings and stuff like that, but, as far as a fuel goes, alcohol is perfect. You could distill it in your backyard if it was not illegal, and dump it in your car. If you had to, you could run your car on, your kitchen scraps.
There you go. There's three examples out of countless examples that I've come across while looking into alternative fuel sources. So, what's the big deal? I'm talking about, alternative energy everybody talks about how I'm always saying energy's free. If you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking for it hard enough. Well, that's true, because everything out there pretty much is fuel. If you use it properly, you can specifically engineer any type of internal combustion engine to run off of just about any type of fuel out there. And so, with that said, now you got a source of electricity that you can build your own home generator that runs, like you just said, off your table scraps, whatever types of fruits or sugar things that you got, leftovers and stuff. When things biodegrade, you can get methane gas. And so, there's methane, there's propane, there's alcohol, all different types of gasoline out there, I guess, and biodiesels and such. So there's no way you can ever run out of fuel. I mean, fuel is the most abundant thing on the planet as far as science goes, but yet here we are in the year 2018 and they're still talking about alternative energy sources and stuff. So with that said, I got another deal. It's like a BBC thing. I'm going to play it and I might get in there and mouth off a bit here and there when they hit a nerve. So let's see what we got here.
We are in a race. The race is against time.
We have to build cities. We need them, but we have to make them in a different way.
We need a wave of innovation, not only for our way of life, but also for the planet.
The consequences would be enormous if we lose this battle.
the consequence is going to be enormous if they lose this battle, man. They got to get clean, renewable, alternative, green energies and build mega cities. They're going to say the world's overpopulated. They're going to say, you know, we got to save the planet from carbon emissions, which is pure ridiculousness, because if they actually knew how science functioned, then they wouldn't be trying to fool the average Joe to believe all that craziness. The fact is, you could build engines that would run so cleanly that you wouldn't have any carbon emissions, and even if there was any type of carbon emissions coming out, you could store that, capture it, store it, and reuse it for fuel once again.
I'm Thomas Getz, executive editor at Wired Magazine. At Wired, we look at the innovators and innovations that are changing our world. In the next hour, we'll see three stories from acclaimed filmmakers about the future of energy. We'll explore cutting-edge innovations in how we drive, how we live, and in our first story, how we fuel our cars. They are all ideas that promise to shape the path to the world of 2050.
2050? We gotta wait till 2050? Are you serious?
The world has right now close to 1 billion cars, and we might double the number of cars on the planet by 2050. So if we double the number of vehicles, we really increase the amount of fuel they consume, and that's going to have a big, big footprint in terms of our demand for resources to move all those vehicles around.
We're pulling up carbon that's been stored underground and burning it in our automobiles and putting all that carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. If we don't reduce that, we could have changes in the climate that we could never recover from.
There's a number of forecasts for what type of transportation economy we could move into. One vision is that we will use more and more liquid fuels. Another one is we'll use more and more electricity. And right now, more of the industrial activity is focused around liquid biofuels.
The thing about a fuel is it's really unparalleled on a weight basis how much energy is in a gallon of fuel. And even if batteries develop as some of the advocates hope they develop, we're not going to see batteries running large trucks, and we're certainly not going to see an electrified air fleet. We're going to need transportation fuels for those that will directly replace the petroleum-based fuels that we're using today.
This has kicked off people looking at a whole range of other alternatives to petroleum in your tank.
I got to pause that for a second. You said that we're certainly not going to be able to see an air fleet of electrified, like, say, airplanes, whatever. If you go out there and check out there on YouTube, there's a lot of people out there who's actually made electric paragliders and electric airplanes and such like that. And these doggone motors are getting more efficient. The batteries are getting more incredible. And the capacitor technology is mind-blowing these days. And so when science finally catches up of energy storage, having electric airplanes not going to be no big deal. There are actually companies out there that sell small versions of electric airplanes, and they get pretty good mileage as far as airplanes go. But nonetheless, from small hop to another different place, you can get to point A to point B on an electrical charge, plus put some juice back in with solar panels incorporated into the wings and actually even the body of the airplane itself. You could be pulling power in, and if you're using that energy properly, you can get super efficiency out of. That's one of the science projects that I'm working on here recently, and I actually need to do another video on YouTube. I've been, if you get an opportunity to go over and check me out on Twitch, I've been doing some live streams here and there for the doggone project that I'm working on. I'll go ahead and see if I can get that link for you folks and repost it again. if you happen to be one of the people over there on Twitch, just and you want to, you know, follow me over there as well. I just kind of randomly go on and do, you know, a live stream video. And so hopefully I'll get that down. I'm actually going to certain circumstances. Could have been doing that today. I was going to live stream while I'm actually doing the radio show as well. So with that said, let me post this link over here in the chat room to Twitch. If you're interested in my newest projects that I'm working on, it's going to be like almost like a virtual lab where while I'm working on the project and live streaming, you can ask me questions about it. So I think that's pretty cool. That's what I wanted to do with the virtual lab deal. So I'm putting that in there. But anyway, that particular project, I've taken a DDS signal generator, and right now I've had it running all night long. It's pulsing at 50 hertz on the square wave. I was pulsing it at 600 hertz, which works fine. But at 50 hertz, it kind of slows the signal down a little bit and gives you almost a little bit of a stronger boost, because I'm actually charging a lead acid battery that I drained completely down so that I could see whether or not this particular system with strictly voltage would actually charge this battery. And sure as heck, it's up to 5.52 volts right now after being gone down to zero. And it's charging while under load. This entire system is charging under while it's under load. So my surplus voltage that I have on the main system itself is sitting at 10.36 right now. On the audio stereo capacitors, car audio stereo capacitors banks with digital readouts, those are sitting at 5.52 volts as well, which seem to be basically the same as the battery, which is sitting at 5.52 volts. So actually those capacitors are, and the circuitry in those capacitors are part of the load that while this thing is charging up, it's actually using part of that energy while it's charging up. And so after I shut the thing off for a while yesterday, the circuitry kept on running for many hours afterwards, and then when I fired it back up before I went to sleep so that I could, you know, run it all night long to see how high I could get that battery, you know, still got those numbers going on. So while it's under load, it's actually still charging. So that's a plus as far as what I've been trying to explain to people about how energy travels and that you can charge with voltage alone. If you get down to the nitty gritty of it, there's probably some milliamperage going on in there or whatever, but that's, it's insignificant to what it is that I'm trying to say. Voltage is pressure, and that's what gets work done. So it's like blowing up a balloon and storing that energy, and once you've got that energy stored, then you can release that energy into the load and be able to run this thing incredibly efficient. So you take the energy off your main power source, and you use it to pulse, you know, a transformer, or dump that energy into a huge storage bank so that you're basically building up a surplus of energy and then moving that energy down the line away from it. So the way that this thing is set up, none of that energy can come back to that signal generator. So it's all moving forward. It's all going in and pressurizing the containers, and it can't come back the other direction, which means there's no way under this particular circumstance that generator, the signal generator, will get, you know, some sort of voltage spike backwards that'll burn the circuitry out. So this thing, I've been running for days at a time, and it's not getting hot, it's not being overtaxed. It's running off of a 5-volt USB charger that's plugged into a surge protector, which is plugged into the main power grid. And so if you start from the 5-point-whatever-volt USB charger down to the signal generator, everything that's got going on right here only requires a little over 5 volts in order to run. And that circuitry inside there is pulsing that 5 volts and pushing out, according to what I understand about this particular signal generator, it produces 9 volts without being under a load. So once it's under a load, then of course some of that voltage would be accounted for. But either way, I'm pulsing a microwave oven transformer, which is pulsing the secondary and taking that voltage and ramping it up to a higher voltage that I am then in turn dumping into AC capacitor banks and running in through a bridge rectifier to change it into DC current, and then charging up DC capacitors and a bank of supercapacitors. See, a main capacitor will store a lot of power, but a supercapacitor will store it more like a battery and give you back current. So when you get the supercapacitor charged up, which normally supercapacitors, they don't like to be charged by current, so they will actually charge with voltage. So you can pressurize a supercapacitor with voltage, but once you get that capacitor up, you can run that capacitor just like it was as if it was a battery. So this is a plus, because all the energy that I'm moving away from that generator is not making it back to that generator, and so therefore it's not making that generator have to work harder. And the reason for running it at different frequencies is so that I can determine at which frequency range is the most efficient in order to do whatever task that I want. So I could run it at 600 hertz and I can move the energy rapidly, or I could slow it down and move higher quantities forward at the same exact time to basically give me a little bit more current on the opposite side of the spectrum there. So it gives that time at 50 hertz to the magnetic field to expand and then fully collapse, so that the majority of that energy moves forward. So with that said, let's get back into this podcast here.
Commercial production of ethanol as fuel started in Brazil in 1975. When we started the ethanol program, nobody talked about reducing emissions. This was an issue at that time. First, and most important, we didn't have money to buy oil anymore after the first oil shock. We were importers of oil. And today, more than 50% of all cars use ethanol instead of gasoline.
Brazil made a very conscious choice to try to find a way to reduce their fossil fuel dependence, and they didn't have to look very far because Brazil's climate is ideal for growing sugarcane.
When you have sugarcane plantation, you have only two things to make, sugar and ethanol. My family has been in sugarcane business since 1955, and about 30 years ago I thought there is opportunity to make more ethanol. Now we are producing.
See, while this particular section is going on, he's talking about using sugarcane. Sugarcane's got two separate fuel sources in it that maybe one of which got overlooked. Obviously the sugar for making ethanol or alcohol or whatever, but the actual husk of the sugar cane itself, that can be used in a gasification system. So you could actually gasify the waste materials. Once you get all the sugar extracted from the cane, you can turn around and use the cane for using a gasifier system in order to produce yet even more gas.
120,000 cubic meters of ethanol.
Brazil today has very close to 400 sugar mills. The overall sales is $30 billion US dollars, and this number is increasing.
If you look at how they make ethanol and how efficient the process is, it's really a model for all of us. They grind the plant up, extract the sugar from the cane. The sugar goes into these large fermentation tanks, which combines sugars together with yeast that naturally produces ethanol. They use the rest of the plant to generate heat to distill the ethanol and turn it into fuel. They also use that heat to generate electricity renewably.
Hear what he just said? They're actually using the, like I just mentioned, about using the rest of the sugar cane for heat to distill the fuel, plus they're using the heat to generate electricity at the same time. So look at that. They're making fuel and using the same product and waste, what would have otherwise been waste products from the same deal, in order to make fuel.
Not putting excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Brazil has gotten to a point today where they're using about 40% less petroleum than they would be otherwise. But Brazil cannot supply the whole world with ethanol because they would have to cut very strongly into food production and into critical natural areas like the Amazon to make that happen. And this really boils down to the fact that there's only so much arable land, and growing fuel for our gas tanks is yet another demand on that landscape.
We cannot kid ourselves in thinking that we found a general solution for the world problem. I think we will have to face the world in this way today. We have no oil in very large quantities anymore. We have no coal transformed in a clean way. In the meantime, we have to do the best we can. And the best at the moment is that we can do biofuels.
Sugarcane to ethanol is an incredibly efficient process. You get out about 7 times the energy you put into growing the sugarcane. In the U.S., when we produce ethanol from corn, for every unit of input of energy, we get about the same amount of energy out. So we're really not gaining anything. We need a better process. We don't have...
There's a misnomer right there, because the difference between what they're doing with the sugar cane is that they're actually using the waste products for heat in order to supplement part of their energy uses to doing that. Over here in the States, whenever they pull that corn up out of there, they shred the corn, but the husk and all that kind of stuff, that's fuel as well. So they could be doing the same process over there. They could learn a lot from these people.
To take what nature has given us, we can actually engineer plants and yeast to be more efficient, and that's the basis for a lot of the work that we're doing now.
What we need to look at, though, is which of the pathways that come out of this are not only good financially, but those that are also good in sustainability. And this equation is really wide open right now.
We are in a race to develop fuels. The race isn't with other countries, the race is against time.
Before we get going too much further, there's also something to factor in that if you're talking about running, you know, a straight biodiesel or even a biofuel of any type or any ethanols or alcohols or natural gases and all that kind of stuff, you'd probably be using more fuel by trying to run it specifically by that. But the hybrid technology out there where they're gas electric is getting so incredible that, you know, you could use less of the one type of fuel while at the same time combining in conjunction electrical technology as well. You know, the new capacitor technology. I keep telling you, go look at Robert Murray Smith and keep an eye on the work that he's doing as far as batteries. He's actually got him a factory set up now, from what I understand. And so pretty soon you might be going to market with some pretty decent batteries, which I can't wait to, you know, get a chance to try out some of his batteries. So with that said, the new capacitor technology, which will store more energy, new batteries technologies, and even old battery technologies. Heck, you can go to the roofing supply store, and they sell these rolls of lead. And you can take these rolls of lead, and you can cut them down into plates, and you can make your own homemade batteries. And instead of using battery acid, you can use pickling salt as your electrolyte inside there. Distilled water and pickling salt. And that'll charge up just like a regular lead acid battery. So there's something to contemplate on if you ever have to try to figure out a way to make your own homemade batteries. It's a ridiculously simple process. So you got a chemical battery going on. And using this process by which I've been trying to explain to people about how to use energy differently, you can use that energy so incredibly efficient and be able to charge up even batteries that normally will not charge up using the normal system, because the current, it's resisting the current because there's a problem with the battery. Maybe one of the cells is bad, this particular method will still charge that battery because of the way that it's actually doing it. It's not trying to force a lot of current down in there. I'll have to do a video and show what it is I'm talking about on that aspect. But either way, even batteries that normally wouldn't be good, you still be able to use them as a storage bank. So with that said, you could take in, if you look out there on YouTube, you'll find how to rejuvenate batteries. One of the methods is to take baking soda and distilled water, and you mix the baking soda with the distilled water, and you drain your battery acid out of your lead acid battery, and then you pour in the baking soda and distilled water, and you watch as it'll start bubbling up as it's eating through the, the trash that plugs up your battery. And then when that finally, after you do that a few times and it finally doesn't bubble anymore, then you know that battery's clean. You flush it one more time with distilled water, and then mix your electrolyte with pickling salt and distilled water, and then charge it up. So there you go. There's another solution how to actually recycle old batteries and get them back to where you can still use them again instead of sending them off to the scrap heap.
To meet the immediate and future demands, we made the energy solution spring from the ground.
Brazil is the most efficient ethanol-producing country in the world. Sugarcane alcohol from Brazil can reduce the total carbon footprint by up to 70% compared with the gasoline.
The biggest challenge for fuel providers and car manufacturers is to reduce CO2 emissions over the next 20 years.
Demand for mobility will continue to grow. We believe that biofuels are very important because they help in an immediate way. All forms of fuel are going to be needed. Hydrocarbons, natural gas, biofuels, all of them are going to be part of the energy mix for the future of transportation.
Brazil has been very successful at taking a resource they had and finding the process to make that into ethanol. And people call those first generation biofuels. We have lots of lab work around the world that are looking at the second generation. And that's generally turning cellulosic material from, for example, wheat into biofuels. And the United States is very much at the forefront of the innovation part of the equation.
And also, one other thing, if you've ever looked into oxygen concentrators and how those things work, if you wanted to recapture any carbon emissions and you wanted to specifically engineer, there are filtration systems that you can actually capture that carbon, and then when the filter actually gets plugged up, the computer would sense a pressure difference in the exhaust and instantaneously put a fresh filter right in line. When it's all said and done, those filters, when they're all used up, could be turned around and recycled back into more fuel again. Plus, the oxygen concentrators themselves, if you look on there, they'll say, you don't want to smoke around these things because oxygen's flammable. So even oxygen itself can be another fuel. And the kicker about all that is the way that this thing actually pulls oxygen out of the air by bringing atmosphere in from the outside, separating and concentrating the oxygen, the hydrogens and the nitrogens will stay behind on one side of the deal, and it'll pressurize the tank with oxygen. So you could even use that particular technology to specifically engineer, because oxygen is flammable, it could be used as a fuel as well. So it's moving along again.
For centuries, we have been using yeast to consume glucose and produce wine and beer. We're trying to do something very similar, only we're engineering the yeast to consume that glucose and turn it into a fuel or a drug or chemical.
we call this synthetic biology. And when I started in this area, many of my colleagues said, oh, Jay, this is great work, but where's the application? What are you going to do with these tools? Who cares? Malaria is an enormous problem. In any one year, a million or so people die of the disease, and most of them are children under the age of five. So we thought this was a great opportunity to engineer yeast to produce an anti-malarial drug called artemisinin.
All right. While we're on this subject right here, malaria is basically a mosquito-borne virus that, you know, mosquitoes fly around from stagnant water and they suck your blood and transmit diseases and such. Well, the same process of fermentation where you're taking yeast, and you can actually look, there's YouTube videos out there where you can build mosquito catchers. That when, because how mosquitoes actually find you is they find you by the CO2 that you're breathing out of your mouth. They're attracted by that. And so when you're fermenting, like you could take some bread, which actually has yeast in it, and some sugar and some water, and you can mix it up in a little deal, and when, while it's fermenting out there hanging in the tree, it's attracting mosquitoes, which then in turn get trapped inside the trap and, you know, basically die. Plus there are actual CO2 generators that use like propane and different types of fuel that when these things are running, they put out a fog of CO2, real heavy fog, and all the mosquitoes in the neighborhood are attracted towards it, which then in turn gets sucked into these fans and up against the screen, and they end up dehydrating and dying. So as far as preventive measurements, even the process by which you're using to make this type of fuel source or whatever, alcohol types of fuel sources or any type for that matter, but anything that's going to off-gas CO2, then you can use that CO2 as a bait to bring these diseased mosquitoes over there and get rid of them by the thousands, if not more.
This drug is derived from plants right now, but it's too expensive for people in the developing world. So my laboratory engineered yeast to produce small quantities of artemisinin. Now that process is being scaled up, and we'll have this drug on the market shortly, but at a substantially reduced cost. It turns out that anti-malarial drug is a hydrocarbon, and it's very similar in many ways to diesel fuel. We thought, gosh, we could turn our attention now to fuels. We could make a few changes in that microbe to turn it into a fuel-producing microbe. If we imagine that glucose is going to be our new petroleum, we need a source for that glucose. And so the crops that we're looking at are crops like switchgrass. This is a native grass that grows without a lot of water and on marginal lands that we could turn into energy farms. The challenge, though, is that unlike sugarcane, it's very difficult to get the sugar out of that biomass. So we use what we call a pretreatment process to extract the glucose from the plant, and then we feed that glucose to a yeast that we've engineered to produce hydrocarbons. And that yeast takes in the sugar.
The process that he's talking about right now also has other applications. You don't have to have just any specific type of plant. Imagine in your general vicinity how many people are mowing their lawn. What do they normally do with their grass clippings? You know, some of them will gather them up in bags and they'll try to take them to somebody who composted, or maybe even to a landfill or something like that. That's a resource that comes right out of your front and backyard. So you could gather up all these grass clippings and you could use what would have normally been a waste or whatever to produce another type of fuel source. So if people out there really seriously wanted to be energy independent and efficient, they could get the entire community to gather up all these grass clippings, turn them into a community fuel source that, you know, you could do so much with and basically benefit the whole entire community. So, you know, especially if you're living out in the country and you're always out there having to mow your lawn, and, you know, a large acreage of land with a lot of weeds and even the dead and dying trees, anything that's carbon-based is fuel. So you could take clean up your natural habitations or whatever. Clean up your wooded areas. Take all the scraps out of there and turn that into another type of fuel source. So somebody tell me where in the heck's the energy crisis.
And it changes its composition and gives us this high energy molecule. They float to the top, you skim them off, you put them in your tank. But it takes a lot of work to get from that small test tube all the way up into the million gallon tank. So we have to give it time, but I think that some of the discoveries that are happening might be applied by the end of the decade. In terms of a sustainable equation for the planet, the role of biofuels is quite tricky. There are a variety of crops that do not compete directly with food, and finding ways to utilize those types of crops first, that's very attractive. So solving the science is part of the story, but then evaluating all of these new fuels in terms of the land use impacts that they could have, that is an even harder story than doing the good science. Imagine that you could have one process that could take in sunlight and carbon dioxide and turn it into fuel. And imagine if that didn't involve growing anything at all.
The synthetic biologists are trying to take plants and make them do things that they wouldn't normally do. On the other hand, materials chemists like myself want to do artificial photosynthesis to improve on the process that nature does in real photosynthesis. We should follow the blueprint of plants converting sunlight into fuel, but take the approach that it could be much simpler. All we really need is a light absorber that absorbs sunlight. We also need a catalyst like iron or nickel. So when you see the hydrogen coming off of the photoactive material, that's an example of a semiconductor breaking the chemical bonds of water to make hydrogen and oxygen. Ultimately, our pieces are going to be contained in something that is easy to roll out like bubble wrap, where in would come sunlight and water. You would vent the oxygen to the air, but the bottom would wick out your liquid or gaseous fuel that then you could collect and use for our cars and planes and storage. Our goal is within 2 years to have the first artificial photosynthesis solar fuels generator that we can hold in our hands. And then we get to scale beyond that time.
We're certainly not good at predicting the future, but to me, electric vehicles look like a sustainable option. We've heard proposals about things as far-fetched as nuclear power plants, and even some proposals to move freight around with lighter-than-air vehicles. And so, if the future in 2050 does include a fair amount of oil, what it means would be that we haven't deployed as many of these clean technologies as we already know are possible.
If you think about how long it's taken for us to build up the petroleum industry, we can't hope to reverse that overnight. It's a huge change in our infrastructure. Yes, we should have been working on it 30 years ago. We didn't. We're trying to make up for that, and that means basic research needs to be done now and by as many people as possible. We have a long way to go, but I'm confident that we'll get there.
In the future, 3D maps are going to help people get places more efficiently.
As we just saw, the race to produce cleaner energy is charging ahead. In the meantime, demand for cars continues to climb. By 2050, it's predicted there'll be 2 billion cars on the planet, and fuel consumption will have tripled. To keep pace, we'll have to radically change the way we drive. Here's our next story, Driven by Design.
the automobile came around. In many ways, it was the future. We thought of it as one of the more positive changes that had happened to society. Suddenly, our ability to get a job changed. We can live farther away with bigger plots of land, with better quality of living. It all looked quite good. But there are limitations to swearing by the car. If it gets congested, your quality of life drops immediately. To spend so long in the car, it's very inefficient use of fuel consumption. Things stop making sense all of a sudden. It doesn't bring you closer to where you want to get. It actually sometimes brings you farther.
The average American spends nearly 300 hours a year in their car, 38 of them stuck in traffic. Annually, congestion consumes over $1 billion in gasoline in the United States alone. The inefficiency caused by traffic, both financial and personal, is enormous. Dirk Sheehan and Carmen White's story is not that unusual today.
Dirk works an hour and a half away in Warrenville, Illinois. Generally, he wouldn't leave work until 6 or 6:30, and I would say a usual time for him to get home is around 8.
Usually when I wake up, I'm the only one up. Sometimes the kids wake up with my routine. More often than not, I don't see them in the morning. I think about my commute when I wake up. I check the traffic report, see if there's any delays. The worst case scenario, it takes me 2 hours to get to work.
We are already so limited in the amount of time he can spend with the kids. And our expenses are crazy high. We are spending $400 a month on gas. It takes away from our food budget, and we never paid for gas like that before, ever.
There's technology that would allow me to spend less time in the car, spend less money on gas, and spend more time at home. I'd be all for that.
The cost of traffic is people's time, it's fuel wasted, it's an emotional toll, it's a frustration. Utilizing the roads more intelligently is a much more efficient approach to the inability to have supply keep up with traffic demand.
You know, while they're complaining about traffic and fuel prices and everything, don't you feel like it's ironic that we're sitting here naming off all different types and methods of refining different materials into cleaner burning fuels and such? So, you know, on a financial aspect, you'd think that it would be more plausible for the average Joe, because you're not going to get the mainstream system to do it, for the average Joe to look into these alternative fuel sources as well and get these basically the equivalents of the home mad science guys to engineer new innovations that otherwise you're going to have to wait till, like they said, 2050 in order to get this type of stuff out there on the market. But by the time it gets out there on the market, it's still going to be expensive. Even if they came out with a water car fuel, they would make it so that it would be so unaffordable for most people, but whoever could afford it, maintenance and all that kind of stuff would be ridiculous. But just think, if you were the one, you and your dream team was the ones that engineered it and knew exactly how to fix it and where any of the possible flaws in the system might be or any weaknesses in the system, you could engineer around those systems to make it better. So it's the difference between who's going to control the technology by 2050. First off, it's 2018. 2050 is a long time down the road. Why it is that more people ain't involved in trying to figure this stuff out before it gets to that point, so that you can enjoy that technology here and now. Well, you've been listening to the Mad Science Show all these years. I've been telling you all different types of alternative methods for energy and fuels, and you've even heard about different alternative medicines. All these things are solutions that if you look into, you might just find that they might benefit you financially as well as health-wise and all that, and even working in harmony with the way that nature does things. So with that said, nature doesn't waste anything, and nature's powerful. There's all kinds of ways that if you understand how to basically tap into what nature's already provided for you, It's like that example I give about, you know, you get on a river in a canoe or something like that, any kind of boat, you can ride downstream for free, you know, just go along with nature, and then whenever you want to get back upstream, if it just so happens the wind is blowing in the opposite direction of the downstream, you can use the wind to get you back upstream again. So nature's already provided the solutions. It's just up to man to pay attention to what's going on. And for the average Joe to basically save their wallet, so to speak, because everything costs money. Electricity costs money, your fuel for your car costs money, and that means you got to work longer hours and more time and maybe be away from your family because you can't afford things, because $400 a month or extra for fuel, that's a bunch of money that somebody could be using for other things. She said it actually cuts into their food budget. So with that said, you know, if you could save $400 a month with some of these alternative technologies available to you, you know, and they're not going to be available to you if you go to ask the mainstream industry, hey, can you build this for me? Nope. And even the governments, you know, because like I said earlier about the petrodollar, you know, everything's backed by oil instead of backed by gold these days. And so they don't want to do anything that's going to tap into that. So your congressmen, your senators, your parliaments, and all the people up at the top who are supposedly your representation, they're in it for the bottom line. They want to make money. They want to keep the money makers happy. So they either take bribes or whatever, or work their way so that they'll have a real cushy job when they get out of these positions with companies and corporations. So they don't have your best interest and they don't have your best representation at heart while they're doing all this stuff. So they're not going to pass legislation that says you have to try to adapt to different types of fuels and by this particular date. It's not going to happen. And as far as running out of crude oil, the oil industry is going to be around forever and a day because it's physically impossible to run out of crude oil. No matter what they keep trying to tell you, it's not fossil fuel. It's fuel that could be made in a lab setting within less than 2 hours. You can make crude oil. It's no big deal. It's heat and pressure, and basically, you know, anything carbon-based material. So biodiesels from algae and different types of plant life and grass clippings and such like that. There's so many different ways to get energy and fuel that it's just ridiculous. This planet is a very good provider if you decide to use it properly.
If you took a satellite picture of the highway, you can see that there's actually a lot of open space. And if we had the technology for cars to drive more closely but safely, then you could increase the utilization of the road network.
What this means is that to be more efficient, to use less fuel, we need to see the road differently. We need cars that can navigate through the urban landscape in a radically different way.
Maps in the future are going to be able to help people get places either more safely or more efficiently. Today just helps you get from point A to point B. But what if I want to get someplace and use the least amount of fuel possible? Or if I've got a hybrid vehicle, I want to make sure I've got plenty of charge not only to get there, but to get back home. So information that is going to help people achieve the more efficient or the safer route is more detailed information about the road than a lot of people realize.
Here's a radical idea when I talk about electric vehicles or even hybrids for that matter. Imagine if you could make a system where you actually had like magnets built into the road. Obviously, you wouldn't want magnets, you know, attracting a bunch of stuff to there. But say you got a car and you got a coil system underneath that car. As you're flying down the freeway, you're actually pulsing those coils with the magnets in that roadway that are spaced out so many distance apart, and you can actually use you know, electromagnetic style systems to where your car helps to charge the road. I say it's a radical idea, but still nonetheless it's still a possibility. So as your car is flying down the road, it's driving over the top of these magnetic fields that is pulsing those coils and putting energy back into your battery. So you're charging your batteries up while you're going down the road. And if your batteries get to a certain charge and you can't hold any more charge, you could have systems by which you'd pull the coils up underneath the body of the car away from where those magnets would have been. And so you wouldn't be charging your car until your voltages drop low. Then it would lower the system back down again and go back to charging your car back up again. So of course, that's a probably radical and expensive idea, but it's still an idea nonetheless. You know, your car itself, if you had a magnet strip underneath your car, number one, any metal pieces that flew out underneath there would get caught up by there, and so you keep the road clean at the same time. But while you're driving that car down the road, you hit one set of coils, which sends a surge of power back to electromagnet to the car behind you that charges the car behind you, and so on. So everybody who's in front of you is helping charge your car, and so on down the line. So there are options available if people really wanted to seriously get into technology such as that. You wouldn't even have to stop to charge your car up. If the system was set up ahead of time, you could be driving your car across basically what would be the equivalence of a slot car track, you know. And with the technologies we have available for switching things, you could be able to turn left and turn right and never one time have to worry about anything like the old slot cars used to have a pin in them, and they had brushes that drug the track in order to run that car around. But you could still use that type of technology and still be able to maintain full control of your car when you're centered up in the road. You're on the track just like a slot car, and you're in control because you got the steering wheel. That's the only reason for that pin on the slot car track was the fact that you have to keep it on the track. And, you know, of course, you'd have to think safety issues. You wouldn't want nobody getting out on an electrical charged road or anything like that. But there's other methods to where you could ensure that it was well away from anybody from being able to get hurt or whatever. And, you know, it's just about where there's a problem, there's also a solution. You could engineer things that would blow your doors off. So basically the equivalence of a slot car track built into the modern day roads. You could run gas engines on there, diesel engines and electric vehicles, and have the electrical vehicles be able to be charged up while they're driving down the road. You could have the guy in front of you and even the gasoline engines adding to the power of the grid, so you wouldn't even have to have a generating station in order to be able to keep power to this road. As long as somebody's moving down that road, you got electricity on that road. And if you're using it in the method like I'm talking about, you can charge it with voltage without a lot of current. So even if anybody did accidentally touch the power grid somehow, they might get the crud shocked out of them, but they're not going to get killed because it's not going to have the amperage that it would have otherwise for your normal power grid style system. So it's something to think about. Here at Mad Science Show, we throw all kinds of ideas out there on the table. You never know what you could come up with. You take that one idea and expand on it. Even to the extent, because I mentioned about you being able to charge batteries with just voltage, when you rub two separate materials together, these two different materials will exchange electrons and build up a static charge. So you could actually use the tires and the roadway and different types of material to use basically the equivalence of a Van de Graaff generator or even a Wimshurst generator, which pulls static electricity right out of the air. So as you're driving down a road, your axles have rotors on them that are built just like a Wimshurst generator, and it's pulling static out of the air, while at the same time the Van de Graaff portion of the system is pulling electrons from the friction of these two materials rubbing together, and that charge is being guided into your storage banks and stored up so that when your batteries get low, you can dump that energy right into your battery, right off the doggone road. So you're picking up the energy on the way through. And even in the hybrid cars, if you think back about what I just said earlier about the doggone oxygen concentrators, how they can pull oxygen out of the air. They can also pull hydrogen and nitrogen out of the air, and you can guide that energy to where you want it to go instead of sending it off into space. You can use that same technology to separate the hydrogen and oxygen and then feed them back in a strategic manner into that engine so that you now have a hydrogen vehicle that is pulling your fuel up as you're going down the road, plus putting energy from the roadway back into your vehicle so that your car always has a full charge and it always has plenty of fuel, so you'd never run out of fuel. You could drive from here to Mexico and back with the infrastructure was in place and never have to stop once for fuel, unless you needed to take a nature break, and then in that case just pull over because you're not tied to the grid, you're just kind of using the power as you're going by. So Where there's a will, there's a way. You could engineer the future in an amazing fashion to where we'd be so incredibly energy efficient. There wouldn't be no waste. The roadways wouldn't be filthy. And it would just be a nice deal.
It's impossible to collect today.
Here in Chicago, Nokia's location and commerce unit is developing the next generation of mapping. LIDAR, sonar, 360-degree video, all are components of what Nokia calls digital mapping.
We use 64 lasers that rotate, and they collect data in a 3D way about the world. It creates what we call a point cloud of information. That point cloud allows us to measure distances then between the points that we collect. That system, combined with the cameras, with higher precision location detection through inertial measurement units, that whole data system allows us to collect 1.3 million points of data per second. Probably within 2 to 3 years, you're going to see 3D maps that are going to integrate the traffic information into your routing to help you understand, if I've got 5 different routes to take, which one is the most efficient today, given the way the stoplights are running, given the way traffic is running. All of those factors are going to be taken into consideration to make sure I've got the best route.
But better mapping that can integrate topography, infrastructure, and density is only part of the answer.
See, and that technology that they're talking about, your car would become a smart car where it would avoid traffic jams and take you on alternative routes or whatever. So, you know, with all the technology we have available, you'd know the best route to go to the quickest method, and your car would be smart and looking out for your best interest. And basically not drive itself, but give you guidance to where, look, if you want to avoid this traffic, we can save a few minutes by going down this way over here, because these are where all these cars are at. It's pretty brilliant.
Another key to improving transport efficiency is building cars that drive themselves.
Autonomous vehicle technology has...
Now, she just said that, but I'll tell you one thing. I ain't never driving a car that's going to drive itself, because you get some doggone hacker into the grid wants to drive you crazy or have some fun with you, or maybe even somebody don't like you or whatever. They drive your car right off a ditch into a ravine or over in the river or something like that. Now, I want to be full control of my car, even in the future. I don't care how smart that car is. Maybe the doggone artificial intelligence running the car might not like me. I might give the car an attitude from start to finish. And it's like, oh, you'll get yours. No, we ain't going that route. Old crazy Shaziz ain't that crazy. We're not going to drive a car that drives itself. I might drive one that can have a conversation with me, but I ain't never giving it the keys to the car, that's for sure.
A tremendous potential to improve efficiency of our road infrastructure.
By removing humans from the equation, we eliminate all the things we do wrong behind the wheel. Speeding, changing lanes too often, merging haphazardly. And by marrying autonomous vehicles with sophisticated 3D maps, we can make driving safer and more energy efficient. That next generation vehicle is being built right now by the Swedish trucking company, Scania.
The solution, as you see it, is that the vehicles can utilize intelligent maps, three-dimensional maps with traffic information, The vehicles will be intelligent and communicate with each other. They will talk to each other, they will talk to the infrastructure. And we will see completely autonomous driven vehicles.
The goal was to have multiple robots and see if they could go 60 miles fully autonomously.
By displaying traffic density in the urban infrastructure in a revolutionary way, 3D digital maps will help create a more fuel-efficient future. But these technologies are limited by the drivers who sit behind the wheel. Some believe that for cars and trucks to be truly energy efficient, they will need to drive themselves.
The technologies coming into play through sensors and capabilities for cars to drive autonomously.
In 2007, the United States Department of Defense held a competition to see if a completely autonomous self-driving vehicle was possible.
DARPA stands for the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. They held a competition to develop self-driving robots that could drive themselves in traffic. The goal was to have multiple robots, turn them loose on a course, and see if they could go 60 miles in 6 hours fully autonomously.
Driving may be one of the most complex things we do every day. Drivers make dozens of decisions at any given moment. One study found that drivers were exposed to over 1,300 items of information per minute.
We make so many decisions when we're driving without even thinking about it. So in creating our vehicle, a great...
DARPA's program there, as you're watching this video, they're running over cones and driving off the road. So I don't think we're there yet, folks. That's what I was talking about. I don't want to know all autonomous or whatever they call it, a self-driving car. That's pure ridiculousness. There's some things that robots will never be able to do better than humans as far as I'm concerned. It's like, maybe pay attention. Well, there might be some robots that could outpay attention some of the people out there. That's blatantly obvious. But as an overall rule, no, you can't beat the human mind.
Pona the Enterprise was developing software to handle lots of sensors, feeding lots of data, and generating a bunch of potential paths that the vehicle might follow. And even though the robot doesn't have the ability to predict the future, by using this fast random path generation, the robot could anticipate a potential accident and choose a path to avoid it, because it's always thinking about what things could the car do next.
No one expects millions of cars driving themselves anytime soon. But there is a place where self-navigating technologies are being optimized to create the vehicle of the future.
We are on the Scania test track outside Stockholm, where we have basically, it looks like in highway, but it's a separate test track where we conduct our own experiments.
Scania, the Swedish trucking company, has recently begun testing its next generation of long-haul truck. Utilizing radar, sonar, and intelligent mapping, they've been able to drastically reduce fuel consumption.
We have this example with platooning, where we make use of the reduction in air resistance or air drag that you get from driving close to each other with heavy-duty vehicles. And in order to control this, you need to know where the other vehicles are, where their position, their velocity, their actions in the near future. And to be very close to the vehicle ahead of you requires that you have very accurate control.
If you look at robotics broadly, there's a wonderful set of research on people looking at schooling of fish and trying to develop the ability for robots to work together like that. So there are wonderful examples from nature of how cooperation can lead to more efficient resource utilization.
You can see it when people are competing in Tour de France. They platoon to reduce air drag. They are not bicycling behind each other that close because it's fun, or because they are racing.
It is because they are reducing air drag sitting behind the man who is leading.
A truck traveling 55 miles per hour expends half its energy just to move the air around it. At 65 miles per hour, that number jumps to almost two-thirds. Even if platooning can reduce the energy used by 10%, the savings would be substantial.
If a vehicle in front of another vehicle wants to brake, it immediately sends out the brake message to the other vehicles, so they actually brake at the same time.
The way we do this is by, we have an automated system. So now, for instance, if I take my feet off the acceleration pedal and turn the system on, the velocity is automatically governed by getting information from the vehicle ahead through its wireless system. We want these vehicles to maintain a short relative distance. So through this system, we can reduce the fuel consumption by utilizing the air drag reduction by 10%. And 10% would mean you will be able to save approximately 8,000 euros per single heavy-duty vehicle per year.
It may be some time before autonomous vehicles make up the majority of cars on America's highways.
Well, there's one other thing, too. Aerodynamics would play a key in the future style cars, as they already do. If you look at most of these cars out there, the high-end sports cars, they got aerodynamics down to a science. I mean, go look at the Koenigsegg. I love that car. Suspensive is all get out, but it's a really fast car and it looks good. So, you know, when you want to talk about efficiency, even those aerodynamics can be improved upon. They actually made a suit for a biker one time that was really super aerodynamic, that would cut down the friction as this biker was riding this bike. It was a suit that he wore that would cut the wind right past him and, you know, help to give him a competitive edge over everybody else.
Nevertheless, some of these technologies are already making their way into our lives.
Now this polar baby wants to sleep. Do you get to pick out books every day, or is it just something
I get to pick out books sometimes.
Okay.
When we look toward the future, the systems will absolutely make it safer and more efficient and less costly for you, and also make your life easier because you're spending less time on the roads.
The city begins to talk, begins to tell you where is their congestion, what's going on in different areas of town. Suddenly, the car becomes a part of a much bigger ecosystem. We can look at how cars interact with other cars, how a car interacts with infrastructure, and us, the drivers, can start to make smart decisions about how to move around. Suddenly, mobility becomes a whole other thing.
No matter how much money they have, no matter how much oil they have, everybody has to go in a different direction.
Yeah, before we get into that, see, if I had my own mad science laboratory with a dream team that had access to all the machinery that we needed to do things, I'd put a lot of these concepts that I keep talking to you all into one nifty basket and show you what's possible. You know, when you talk about a self-charging electric vehicle, first off, if you're trying to use like a motor generator to charge itself, you have to fight against some, lens effects and cogging and stuff like that, and friction and all the possible losses. But all of those have a way around it. By the way, you move the energy out, which is what this experiment that I was talking about earlier that I'm sharing with everybody has to do with, about moving that energy in a different fashion. Not to mention, if you have two separate systems, one which is actual wheels of your car, and you're, using regenerative braking as far as for brakes to slow you down, that's also going to generate some back energy and maybe even some heat from the brake pads themselves, that is energy that could be recaptured. However, at that same point, if you had the same type of systems going on there, but you added a supplementary system, which essentially would be like the equivalence of a motorcycle wheel on the inside of your deal where you couldn't actually see it, but it's touching the ground, as you're driving down the road, the faster you go, it's spinning up generators. They're making all kinds of hub motors these days that could be instantaneously turned into generator systems. While you're driving down the road, you're producing energy, and if you move it towards the battery bank without having these two interfere with each other using this process that I'm talking about, then you would be able to charge that battery while you're driving down a road using what the car is already doing anyway. And so with that said, you could make incredibly efficient long-range electrical vehicles that you wouldn't have to stop and charge themselves up. So there's so many different options available out there, including using the aerodynamics to, when you're driving down the road, you could guide some of that air in through, you know, duct works that would turn turbines and do the same thing as well. And so, you know, all it is a matter of how far you want to take your ingenuity, your ideas. You know, an idea is only good as how far you plan on taking it. You could take those ideas and expand on them, and other people in your dream team would help you to expand on them. Dad, what happened there? Oh, okay, never mind, we're all right. So, anyway, there's all kinds of options available. Let me see, I think old Ted's sending me a message. Just finishing up with class. We'll call in a minute if that's okay. Yeah, cool. All right. Looks like Ted's going to be joining us in a minute. So anyway, I'll give you tons and tons of examples. I'm going to play some more of this podcast before old Ted shows up there.
We've seen that changing the way we drive can improve transportation efficiencies. What if we change the way we build and live in our cities? That's the subject of our next story, Searching for Utopia. We'll travel to the United Arab Emirates and discover a city rising out of the desert. Let's take a look.
Masdar City in Abu Dhabi will be the city of the future and the role model for the world.
Once you see what they've envisioned for this utopian city, it's very impressive. It's carbon neutral, pedestrian-friendly, and powered by renewable energies. But I do notice we're going to have to change our relationship with cars.
Welcome to Masdar City. أهلاً بكم في مدينة مصدر.
We are driving in the bowels of Masdar City in an electric transportation system. Slightly unnerving to seeing this for the first time. Where are we going?
The first big move the architects at Foster and Partners made was to put all transportation underneath the city, leaving the streets of Masdar totally free of cars. The place reminded me of a medieval city, and actually, many design elements are adapted from ancient Arabic towns and villages.
It's all about looking back into history to move forward. There's some very, very simple ideas that have a huge impact. This is the pedestrian zone, there's no cars here. This has enabled us to push our streets together to take the advantage of shade, channel the cooling breezes through. The whole scale here is based on the human being, it's not based on the motor car. As soon as you lift up the pedestrian plane by 7 meters, you've suddenly captured this breeze. What you can see here in the balcony is we've got a modern interpretation of an ancient Arabic screen. What we must avoid is direct sunlight hitting any piece of glass. As soon as the sun hits the glass, the heat's transferred into the building and we have to use more energy to cool it down.
Can this really make all that much of a difference?
Yeah, absolutely. For example, downtown Abu Dhabi, 60 meter wide streets, black asphalt, mirrored, reflective buildings, no relief from the sun. On a day in September, the air temperature in both places was 39 degrees. In Abu Dhabi, the temperature measured at the asphalt was 57 degrees. In Masdar, the temperature measured on the ground, 33 degrees. So we've actually lowered the air temperature. We're trying to do as much as possible with as little as possible.
These simple design moves cut air conditioning needs by 60%. But this place is also technically very sophisticated. The roof panels not only provide shade, they also generate electricity. And the walls themselves are made of glass-reinforced concrete, literally sand taken from the desert. Everything here is geared towards maximizing energy efficiency.
Masdar does represent a whole different value system. It represents an acknowledgement that eventually everybody has to go in a different kind of direction. No matter how much money they have, no matter how much oil they have, no matter anything else. All of the cities here in this part of the world have come out of nowhere. There was nothing here not so long ago except small settlements in the desert. And then all of this oil and all of this money, and suddenly, you know, wham, these cities started popping up. But they sprung up in a false love of a Western model that was already out of date. The model of the late 20th century automobile-based energy-hogging city.
There's a quiet spot there. Yeah. So, basically, you just...
For most of the world, energy is very expensive.
Yeah, cut me off while I'm talking. Basically, you just heard an example of a place where they're taking every possibility from the way that they design and allow airflow naturally through the place to cool things down, from gathering up sunlight to the way that they use their transportation system. This is something that I'm sure that, you know, maybe by 2050 we might start implementing all this stuff, but this is stuff we could have already been implementing all along. We could have already lived in their so-called utopia if we wanted to. And even if you don't want to live in that type of scenario, at least ways you could make yourself so doggone energy efficient that you're not, stuck under the gun of paying the man all the time for your energy usage.
But the United Arab Emirates is sitting on 10% of the world's oil. And energy is cheap. So cheap, you can run a ski slope in a shopping mall and build the world's tallest skyscraper. But even here, cheap energy won't last forever, and the people behind Masdar are determined to find alternatives.
Alright, so it looks like Ted's joined me, so I'll go ahead and stop the podcast for now and just have a conversation with Ted. How you doing there, Ted?
I'm good, Shazaz. Good morning to you.
Cool. We've been talking about the fuel crisis. Yeah. Did you know we had a fuel crisis?
Yeah, we definitely do. We've definitely got crude oil at a record low, and refineries are still charging $3.75 for diesel around here. So there's something really wrong.
That's all a joke, man. Because I just spent the last couple hours explaining to people everything from running engines using alcohol and different things and methods by which you can use gasification. Water is fuel, even to the extent of making all different types of biodiesels with waste grass clippings and wood and all the different stuff that you basically see laying out on the ground. So as far as us ever running out of crude oil, that's all a big hoax. It's basically the way that they use for if you don't have a lot of something, I can't remember what the actual terminology is of their artificial something or another. Doggone it, what's the word I'm looking for? Artificial scarcity. So they don't want to tell everybody, well, we're running low on oil, it's hard to get oil, and so we got to charge more for it. What's where you see the fuel prices at your gas pump, when in reality, it's not even possible for us to ever run out of oil. We can make crude oil in a lab setting in less than a couple hours because we know how it's formed, heat and pressure, and the carbon-based materials. So with that said, everybody out there thinks we're going to run out of crude oil one day because it's scarce, it's rare, it's hard to come by because, you know, there was only so many dinosaurs. Cracks me up. Anyway, they're being fooled, they're being shammed. That's what's up with that. So what do you think of that there, Ted?
Well, I think you're probably on something there. I feel like the oil of the earth is like the blood or like the lymph fluid of the earth. And it's a natural process, and, you know, your body creates more blood naturally, even if you get taken out. And it can produce so much until, you know, if you start pulling gallons out of your blood, you're going to die. Even liters.
Well, yeah, your body produces oil. That's how people end up with pimples, you know, zits, because dust will get down in your pores and mix with that oil and clog up your pores, which is supposed to be so it can cool you down, and that natural oil that your body makes is helps keep your skin soft and all that kind of stuff. So it's a naturally occurring thing, you know. If you keep your pores clean, that oil won't mix with the dirt and cause you to get a zit.
Right.
So,
well, I mean, right. I mean, the way I view it is just as goes get out of balance with it, and then, you know, it's kind of sloppy and messy. I think the real architects of whatever this is like appreciates efficiency and resourcefulness and true utilization.
Yeah.
I met a chemical engineer once that told me, he was like, buddy, he's like, I'm not a chemical engineer anymore. I do construction work, carpentry. But he's like, you know, if we knew, he's like, we know enough to know that the last thing we should be doing with the oil is burning it. Because, like, from a chemical engineer process, like the synthesis as possible from the crude oil is like infinite. They don't really even understand how to even fully utilize the crude oil from, like, what you're saying, having that, like, carbon, you know, base form, and then being able to create almost anything out of it.
Yeah, they make rubber, plastics, all kinds of stuff. Heck, all the medical supplies that come from petroleum products.
Yeah, he was saying it doesn't do us justice to burn it. We should be using it for other means.
Yeah, especially when we've got other fuel sources available, such as, you know, like I mentioned earlier, grass clippings, you know. You realize how many people mow their lawn and they try to get rid of the grass clippings? They'll either send it off to a landfill, or in some areas, because the landfills are getting plugged up too quick, they don't want the grass clippings, so they'll try to send them to people who have compost heaps, which are going to basically turn that fuel or that old grass clippings into future soil and fertilizer. So, you know, there you go. You got doggone fuel source in your front and backyard. You know what I'm saying?
But it reminds me of, like, well, what's good bacteria doing on your skin all day long? Like, it's going around, doing work, cleaning up, killing off bad bacteria, cleaning, utilizing. It's like if humans could realize their place in the world, start taking care of the earth like we are what we are, the bacteria that's trying to, you know, make the earth a beautiful thing, be a lot more beneficial, and then I think we'd find our purpose more. There'd be a lot less depression.
Well, you're right. We're in the scientific utopia right now, man. We have knowledge of how everything works, and if we just, you know, utilize it, work in harmony with nature, man, we would have it made. You know, there wouldn't be nobody hungry, wouldn't be nobody homeless, wouldn't be nobody dying of thirst or anything like that. We have technologies that are just mind-blowing. It just takes the brilliant individuals out there to put those pieces of the puzzle together to move us into the future. But the key is, I'm trying to tell the world out there, you're not going to get it through the governmental systems or even the corporate systems out there, because they got a bottom line. They want to make money. Why tell somebody you...
I agree, and then, but also, there's not really a lot of demand for it. Like, there hasn't been a market. I think they would... If there was, like, somebody killing it on making kits, like, for making projects of these natures, like home do it gasifiers, home do it, you know, all this, all that, water heaters, all this thing. Like, and people were selling, like, kits or something, and then them corporations seeing their bottom line that they were missing out on these kits, they start selling them.
Well, there you go.
That's
Because
once they see that their bottom line is being ate up by somebody else, in the marketplace, they're vicious. They want it at a greed, they would want to sell it.
That's a good point there, Ted. That's how the average Joe can win this game and make some money in the process. Start designing yourself solar heating systems. Man, there's so many different ways where you could use greenhouse technology to heat and cool your home. You know, if you got a little bit of
so much room for people that are like a little bit younger with some of that Arduino and computer skills, and they could really revolutionize anything at their fingertips if they only wanted. There's so many room for so many, like maybe like millionaires or, you know, just people making it on their own, not even like super wealthy, just because they're taking advantage of all this technology and the fact that how cool would it be to utilize a lot of this in an average use, and then how, you know, a lot of people would probably end up wanting to pay for that.
Yeah. And that's the thing. The average Joe takes it upon themselves to start building dream teams and doing this kind of stuff and, you know, actually producing a market. You know, you don't have maybe the skills to build this, but we'll build it for you, you know, if you just help us with our research or maybe reimburse us for our, you know, time and labor or materials or whatever, and we'll build it for you and you can tell your friends about it and so on down the line. Look how many different avenues that you could go at with that. You see what I mean? There's technology out there to pull water right out of the air. So you can purify and pull water right out of the air. There's also technologies out there in the health industry that are perfect fuel sources because you can separate hydrogen and oxygen using this particular process. And then you could use that as a fuel source to run generators or heating systems. So we got way above and beyond all the technology necessary. We got all the information needed. It's just taking those pieces of the puzzle and putting them together. So, like me personally, whenever I look at a machine like a dehumidifier, I understand how it works and I understand what it could actually be used for. Initially, it's used for pulling the humidity out of your house so that you know, not living in a humid climate, and it'll keep the moisture down and that kind of stuff so you don't get mold problems going on. But that same exact technology could be used to purify water. You see what I mean?
Absolutely.
So, we got the options. We just need to use it. That's it. And the only ones that can, you know, get started on it now, where it's going to be a difference of, is the people going to be in control of the technology in the future? Is it going to be open source, or is it going to be all patented and copyrighted by corporations that say you can't sell this or whatever? And it doesn't matter how many copyrights and patents they got out there. There's ways to improve upon and build different systems using multiple different ways to go about to get to the same end result. You got electricity, it's clean, renewable energy. You can sell that new device under your own patent and help to fund other people's research with the profits and such.
I mean, right, in a way, the whole patent system is kind of open source. As long as you're improving on it, you can re-patent it. And,
that's it.
You know
there's somebody once said, there ain't nothing in this world that hasn't already been invented. That's not true, man. There's better ways and methods of doing things. Every single system that has been produced to this point has a weakness in it. That weakness could be exploited into fixing it and making it better. And basically, you know, there's a lot of the situations where if you change up a patent and it's not exactly the way that they built it, and it's just an improved model of it, you can still sell it. So, there you go, man. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's up to just everybody to do what they wish to do. If they want to take part in utilizing the technology and exploring it, then they can.
Well, my ultimate
goal... If they don't want to take part in exploring technology or whatever, and more interested in sports or whatever, they can.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter.
That's where
At the end of the day, we're trying to improve. I like to go back to the Bible, whether people like it or not. I mean, I believe in the teachings of Jesus just because when you look at them, they're pretty good ideas.
Yeah.
Treat others the way you want to be treated. You know, give somebody the shirt off their back if they're trying to steal. Help them. Raise them up.
Yep.
Pick them up. Help them. And it's like, you know, in the Old Testament, it says, like, we're supposed to be stewards of the earth. And I never really feel better than when I'm walking around in the woods or I'm out working outside. Like, it might not feel good at first, It's almost like playing cards. I never really want to play cards. Once I start playing cards, I'm always having a good time, good conversation with friends. But if it's like the same with nature, it's like, well, I don't want to go out there. But the second you're out there, it's like revitalize everything. Yeah. I think we really are supposed to be utilizing the technology we have to enjoy ourselves while we are working forward to help make Earth a better place for the generations to come.
We could actually improve upon our environment because some of the technology available has the capability of releasing fresh oxygen into the air.
Of the technology we talk about could improve the relationship we have with the Earth. And one of my friends is Jewish, and he's like, you know, we don't necessarily believe in heaven the way I was taught. He's like, the way you all do, like, kingdom of heaven, like Christian, whatever. He's like, Hebrew heaven means earth to come. And heaven literally means, like, what comes to the next generations. Like, you build up heaven on earth for the people that come next.
Well, see, that's kind of like what I like.
That's pretty interesting. You know, I never heard anybody explain it like that.
That's kind of like what I like as far as us being like the founding fathers of, our future generations. We paved the stones, and if we make it right for them, heck, they can live in that utopia that we all keep talking about. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to become selfless, and we want better for the next generation that we change our ways.
Yeah.
But while if we're mostly concerned with how our life is going and me and what I want and what this and that and maybe just like my immediate and my love for my kids only am I thinking about, then the world doesn't really improve quite the same way.
Yeah, my only grievance with the whole environmentalist folks out there is they don't really understand science enough. They just listen to all the hearsay and what people's trying to tell them about carbon emissions and all that kind of jazz. You know, even though they've been educated to the extent of what the system wants them to know and nothing more, nothing less. The proof of that is in the medical industry, because in the medical industry, I talked about oxygen therapy, hyperbaric oxygen treatment, where they're having really good results over there in Texas and California of healing really nasty wounds that would have otherwise led to amputation. And they're saving people's lives and their limbs at the same exact time. But you talk to different doctors out there, some of which have never even heard of that. You know, some of them haven't heard of the technology. They ain't done any kind of researches in it. And if they had heard about it, it was only like briefly they heard something about, you know, people looking into hyperbaric treatments and stuff like that. But that kind of...
There's like a kind of like a fake guild of learned people or smart people or whatever, educated, and they basically, I've noticed what it is, and it's basically a regurgitation of whatever was on NPR that morning. And it's like, as long as they have those common talking points, they feel like they're all in the know and very educated about the current events, and then that'll be what they talk about that day. And as long as you talk about what was on NPR on the way to work, like, you're real smart. Like, I work in higher ed, like, that's what it is. And it's like, and I'm like, you know, because it's like, really, like, that might be how you pass a test. Like, these days, like, there is no essay question. That takes too long to grade, you see.
Yeah.
So if you just want to run the numbers through the scan machine. And, to listen to NPR and then talk about whatever they said about carbon credits, or whatever they said Libya was doing to hurt us, or whatever they say about all that, and you go and regurgitate it, as long as you say the exact same thing the right way, you're smart.
Yeah.
And it's like, huh.
Not only
and
that.
And NPR may be like fair and balanced or more left or right or whatever it is, but it's like, huh. It's like at the end of the day, nobody's doing much research. Like, oh, you read it in Newsweek and I read it in Forbes.
Yeah,
great.
Not only that, while they're being able to be educated in repeating the doctrine that's been spewed out to them, basically propaganda, they're really good at that. But while they're sitting there at like Walmart or Price Chopper or any of the stores for that matter, if you go to a modern day store and watch the cash register, they don't even, to some extent, they don't even do any kind of mathematics. The computer does it all. They scan it in, or they push a button that has a picture of like a McDonald's with a hamburger, you know, you want to buy a cheeseburger, there's a picture of a cheeseburger, and you click on that, and how many ever they want. And so when something goes wrong with that system, because they're so used to the computer doing all the work, they have no idea how to calculate up your change. Have you ever seen, when you go to the store and those folks, whenever suddenly something goes awry, they got to call the manager over there to try to sort out how much money to give you back?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's crazy. Stephen Gibbons put a link in the chat room for how U.S. Navy plans to produce jet fuel from seawater on board the aircraft carriers. It says the U.S. Department of Defense, DOD for short, is the single largest consumer of fuel in the world, and jet fuel accounts for 71% of the entire military petroleum consumption. Therefore, DOD needs to maintain a strong logistical support to provide jet fuel for its equipment across the world. So, I won't go ahead and waste time reading this whole deal, but you can get the general idea of what I just said. They'll be driving around on their fuel, man, picking their fuel up on the way. Ain't this what we've been talking about for a long time, Ted?
Well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, fishing. It's amazing, man.
And we mentioned earlier about alcohol and methanol and ethanol, all these different alcohol, different forms, names of alcohol that could be made that, you know, I started off by putting there in the chat room about a fuel crisis with a question mark, and I put a bunch of videos in there that had to do with running your doggone car on essentially either bootleg moonshine or off-the-store shelf grain alcohol. These people running their lawnmowers with it, and they're running cars with it. Even Mythbusters said that you can do it. You know, whereas they kind of poo-pooed it at the beginning because the one of them was a carbureted. It was like a 73 Camaro that they were running with a carburation system, and it didn't want to work so well. And then the other ones was a 90s version of a car. And it worked a little bit better until they got all the way up to the modern day where the brain in the car could compensate for the fuel-air mixture, and it ran fine with you know, alcohol. So with that said, if they would have known, if they, I know they knew, all they had to do was a few modifications to that engine to change the size of the jetting or whatever, or change the airflow mixture on there. They could have got them older style cars to run on the same thing. The guy that was running his lawnmower, all he did was open the choke a little bit.
Now hold on here. Now what is MythBusters trying to say here? Now I mean, I seen the movie Grease. They running cars on white lightning since the '20s or whatever.
Yeah,
bootlegging.
And the doggone.
So, I mean, what are they there to prove here? They call me that in the fourth grade or whatever. But.
Yeah, the doggone old moonshiners back in the day got wise and started putting the moonshine in the gas tank of the car. They cleaned the gas tank out real good, and they put the doggone fuel inside the gas tank. So if the old lawnmower got behind them, all they had to do is outrun them until all the fuel's gone, and if there wasn't no alcohol, there ain't no evidence.
That's wild.
Yeah.
That's
really
wild.
So people been running vehicles on water, they've been running vehicles on alcohol, they've been running vehicles on chicken grease and vegetable oils and all kinds of biofuels.
I mean, at least what I understand from what I learned is that the guy that invented the diesel engine invented it to run on sunflower oil. I think he was a German. I don't think he was from the United States.
He also had a method by which it was actually going to burn coal dust too.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I've seen fields of sunflowers are real beautiful.
Yep.
Also, sunflowers pull like unwanted heavy metals out of like toxic soils.
Yeah, there's all kinds of benefits from sunflowers, even the seeds.
Yeah, they're good. They're good for them.
But the point is, all this time, we've had all this technology, and for anybody to come out there in mainstream and say we got a fuil crisis like the old 70s Arab oil embargo that they talked about way back when it's hard to get gas for your stuff and all that, it's all a hock-a-hooey all to begin with. They had more than enough oil. there's wells in Texas that they had closed down, the oil wells had ran dry, and then years later they came back and to see what to do with the land, they found out these doggone oil wells had done filled themselves back up again. So they didn't open them back up every time, but you know, that's because there were certain entities willing to pay them to not open it up, because suddenly you'd be filling the market with more oil, which would bring the price down again. You see what I mean?
Well, I was hearing from some old landman that was studying them monatomic particles down there in like Texas or whatever that they had found a vein in his geology work that was making gold, and then they'd come back every so many years and there'd be more gold there.
Well, there you go, man. See, nature, whatever process nature did to make any certain element or chemical, that process is still going on right now as we speak. So there's new coal being made, new diamonds, new gold, new everything. This earth regenerates itself. It basically recycles everything. There's nothing that you ever used that isn't part of the system still. It doesn't matter. When you burn that firewood, all you did was change the makeup of that firewood, the chemistry of it. And those were chemistries that were involved in making that firewood to begin with. See what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So, look, folks, if you can't find free energy, you ain't paying attention to mad science. That's for sure. While I'm saying that, jump over there to the super chat room. And if you haven't already, go up there and attend the University of Mad Science. And if you need a little bit of, refresher study before you go, you can click the link underneath there, Stephen's resource page, where he's acquired and put together a whole bunch of links to all kinds of alternative energy researchers. And underneath that one is a link to my Twitch TV, where I'm going to be broadcasting live stream experiments so that you can actually be in the chat room and talk to me while I'm doing experiments. Give me ideas. I give you ideas and that kind of stuff. But either way, go back up there to the University of Mad Science and take the test to see if you can graduate from the University of Mad Science. When you take the test and print out your diploma, hang it on the wall proudly, and that way you can tell everybody you have a degree from the University of Mad Science. You are an official mad scientist. So when you do that, let me know you graduated. Let me know how many times you had to take the test in order to pass. So basically share that link with everybody so we can see how many people would be qualified now for the Dream Team because they have a diploma. What do you think about that, Ted?
That's pretty cool. That's a good idea.
Have you ever took the test?
No, I ain't never done that.
About George, when are you around next time you're around your computer where you can get on and use a keyboard, go take that test and let me know how you fared on there and print out your diploma if you pass and hang it on a nice plaque on the wall so that you could say that you're a mad scientist when somebody says, do you got any degrees? Yeah, I've attended the University of Mad Science. I got my degree hanging right on the wall. What do you think?
That's pretty cool. Yeah, I like that.
Cool. It's easy to be a mad science. All you got to do is be able to pay attention in school, pay attention to the school of nature. Nature will teach you a lot of stuff if you listen in. Observe the scientific method, test and repeat and try it out. Try it before you deny it kind of stuff. Get your feet out of the box and stand outside and look at the big picture. That's the easy way about it. Then you'll start seeing things that you never noticed before. Because when you're down there in that school indoctrination, they tell you to keep your head down and this is the way it is and you memorize this and you'll pass their class. Yeah, don't ask them no questions, Ted. When you go to school, don't ask them no questions. Because they don't like that. I said, the book tells you what you need to know. Just repeat.
But I'll never forget. We had science class in like third grade or something. It was kind of like music. Once you were in a certain grade around here, you got to go to the science class. Like your average teacher didn't teach you science no more.
Yeah.
And our teacher, he has had big hair and a beard, and he was pretty cool. And I'll never forget. It was like the first day in science class, and I was like, "Oh, this is exciting! This is real exciting." He was teaching us about the atom.
Yeah.
And he was saying like you know, there's a center, and these things spin around it. And I was like, I remember it like yesterday. I like raised my hand and I was like, "Yeah, Mr. Keller, why does the atom spin around it?" And he looked at me like I was a complete idiot. And I was like, "Oh no!" I was like, "I asked the wrong question for some reason." And like he looked at me and he just like paused for a minute. And he's like, "Because it does." And I was like, "Huh?
What kind of answer is that?"
Like, I didn't ask no more questions in that class because I was like, "Huh?" And I was like real young, but I knew at that point that like, even though I was young, I wasn't an idiot. I was like, "Man, like people must not know much." You know what I mean?
Because
my dad would have told me that's a bad answer. Like I'd get my ass whooped for saying I don't know to something. It was pretty much like yes sir or no sir. And if you said I don't know, you were in trouble. You had to come up with something better, make an educated guess or something. So when he just said it just does.
They don't want you to know that kind of stuff, man. They don't want you to ask questions. They want you to repeat. As long as you can repeat, you got it made. So, where do we go to from here? Did I lose you, Ted?
No, I'm here, brother.
Alright. So
you were asking me where do we go to? I thought it was a rhetorical question.
Yeah, where do we go to from here?
Well, I just think that we should try to be nicer to everybody and be patient and try to be understanding. And then when we're doing that and trying to become better people, we'll get more messages in our dreams and learn how to do science better. And doors will open and we'll meet people. And then we'll all share more, we'll learn more, and eventually the market for these things will just come around. That's what I believe.
Cool.
Natural. Nature doesn't make catastrophic change very often. Nature works slow.
Alrighty then. So, basically, I think we covered a whole lot here on today's show. Basically, you know, they've been saying for years that there's a fuel crisis. They've been saying there's an energy crisis. They said we needed clean, renewable, alternative energy sources. Then a guy like me and other guys stepped forward and said, okay, we can resolve this, and they did. And some of the ones who basically put on solutions right on the table in working devices, they didn't fare so well because society, while one hand asking for a solution, turned around and didn't want to accept the solution once it was taken, once it was given. And so people didn't fare so well. So we've lost a lot of brilliant researchers, via accidents and suicides and that kind of jazz. And where back in the doggone 70s, Stan Myers was driving around in a dune buggy running on hydrogen technology, and everybody liked to basically poo-poo that idea. Stephen Gibbons posted a link inside the chat room for the doggone how U.S. Navy plans to produce jet fuel from seawater on board the aircraft carriers. Now see, there's a lot of stuff inside of seawater. There's salt in there, obviously. There's water, which is hydrogen and oxygen. Plus there's like planktons and stuff like that, which could be turned into biodiesels. And so if they figured out a chemical reaction by which to take something like planktons out of the water to turn it into fuel, you know, or algaes or whatever, there you go, man. Right out of the gate. Now I don't suggest that they go pull all the planktons and algaes out of the water, but it's just an example. You know, just the hydrogen technology, you could put the planktons right back in the water for that matter, if you done the process properly. But it's still, there's tons and tons of options. we have so many different options for different types of fuel. We have technical engineering skills to be able to do all kinds of things with electrical and fuel consumption, efficiency. This latest project that I'm working on, it's going to show a completely different manner to pull energy off of generators. And right now, this is a solid-state signal generator that I'm pulling the energy off, but the same exact process will work on any standard generator as well. So you don't have to force that doggone generator to give you the power that you want. You can extract that energy off of that generator and be able to move it away from the generator, so the generator doesn't have to work nearly as hard as it would have otherwise running it in the conventional sense. That's what Gerard Morin was showing people by the method that he was talking about. And that's what other people have been trying to point out for a long time, such as John Bedini and his brother. They had technologies that if people would have paid attention to what they were trying to say and moving that energy away from the generator, and there's different methods to do it, one of which is plasma. You turn that energy into a completely different form of energy, such as light and heat, it's still energy. And I said this a million times, even their mainstream laws of physics says energy can neither be created nor destroyed. So where does it go? It's still there. Even if you change the form, even if you sped it up, slowed it down, stored it, or whatever, it's still the same amount of energy. It's still energy, no matter what. And with that knowledge in your head, now you can move this stuff away in such an efficient manner, change it to a form that that generator is not going to be fighting with in order to try to use that energy. And if you know that when you work something too hard, it's going to get hotter faster, and heat is one of the things that will cause things to fail because it reaches its thermal breakdown, we even have methods by which to ensure that our equipment never breaks down. If you understand the weakest point of that system, that's your starting point for making that system better. If your seals or whatever will break down at this particular temperature, that means you have to keep maintain the temperature of that engine underneath that. Otherwise, that seal will reach its thermal breakdown and it'll fail. You'll generate an oil leak or whatever, you know. And so that's where the radiator system comes in. But if you move that energy away from that, or even build a focused heat engine like the one that I explained and drew pictures of, that you only need that heat in the cylinder for combustion. You don't need the heat all over the outside of that engine. So why are you putting it there? You can send it wherever you want it to go. You can guide the energy wherever you want it to go. You can get it to do what you want it to do. That's the smart way to use energy. And there are no losses that way. Nothing is wasted. You might use the frictions of the bearings. Just the frictions of the bearing be just enough to keep the oil at its proper viscosity without having all that extra heat that is generated from the vibration or the combustion portion of the gasoline engine or diesel engine for that matter. That extra heat actually makes that oil get thinner quicker, but just the friction of it, because you want some temperature to that oil so that oil can flow freely. You want to keep it warm, but you don't want it to get hot. Just the frictions of the bearing would generate enough heat to keep the oil thin so that it's pumped through the entire system without causing it to fail. And so you never have to worry about your parts breaking down. The only time your bearings and anything like that break down is when the oil itself gets so thin that it loses its viscosity, and suddenly now you got part against part, and the softer part is obviously going to be the one that gets tore up first. So that's why you'll have inside your bearing housings, you'll have bearing seats that it actually will tear up the race of the bearing, which is the bearing seat itself, or before it tears up the bearing seat, it will tear the race up. And so if you catch it in time, then all you got to do is replace that bearing in the race that the bearing's riding on, and so you don't tear your engine block up and you can still rebuild it. But if you have the temperature under control from start to finish, that bearing will never eat into the race. You'll never have to change the bearings on your vehicle, on your engines, or your machinery. That's the simple of it. You know, they don't make things to last anymore. If you go back and look at some of the older technology and the way that they were done and self-lubricated, they over-engineered some things, and some things from way back in the 1800s and early 1900s are still working as good as they would have if they came right brand new off the store shelf. That's some engineering. That's some quality. Now, taking that in consideration and going to the modern day, even an aluminum block and the materials that we use today, the different types of alloys, you can engineer that doggone piece of machinery to be so incredibly efficient that there ain't even no vibration involved in this thing. There's ways to insulate between two solid deals like the motor mounts in your car. If it wasn't for the motor mounts in your car having a little piece of rubber in between them, have you ever rode in a car that had solid motor mounts, Ted?
No, but I've had my motor mounts go out before.
Yeah, well, if you're in one that has a solid motor mount, those things will rattle your teeth out. They'll vibrate stuff off the... they'll even open the glove box because it's rattling so bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that vibration of the engine's translating through the frame of the car now. But and then that and the fact that all the torque involved in, you know, you smash on the gas will break parts. And so they put a piece of rubber in there to absorb that sudden impact of that, you know, stomping on the gas thing. But if you do it right from start to finish, and you got that engine so perfectly balanced that it's not even vibrating, you could run solid motor mounts and wouldn't feel it. But the best bet is to use some of the old knowledge where they used rubber to be an absorption in between there, so none of any what would have been vibrations would have that opportunity to translate through to the frame of the car. And therefore you save parts, because some electrical parts don't like to be shaken up. You know, your shock absorbers in your car, when they fail, you'll have a bumpy ride going down the road. And that one shock absorber end up, after a while, getting so bad that it'll punch a hole right through the unibody of the car, and you'll have a shock absorber every time you hit a bump coming up in and out of your trunk.
Uh-huh.
We got ways around that. So... you know, it's all about engineering. It's all about taking these ideas in this time where we're standing at a crossroads right now where we have access to all this technology and decide where we want to take it in the future. If we the people decide we want to build a utopia, then we should be working on it right now. There are a lot of people, including myself, who are doing alternative energy research. And so with that said, I threw a link in the chat room to my Twitch TV so you can actually watch as I do live stream experiments where you can actually get in there and ask me questions while I'm, you know, live streaming. So if you see something that you think would help to make the project better, you could throw your 2 cents worth in there, or if you had questions about it, you can ask me real time. That's what that's all about. So,
wait, are you live streaming the show today?
No. So, I should have, because I got that project that I've been trying to show people, but right now I'm actually charging a lead acid battery and the entire circuitry off of the 5-volt input to the signal generator, and my surplus voltage on the main circuit is 10.35 volts, so that's over what I'm using as far as volts-wise from the input side of it. And the two car audio amplifier capacitors, they're sitting there maintaining at 5.51 volts. And the lead-acid battery that I drained down completely before I started the project, it's all the way up to 5.50 volts and rising. So while it's under load, it's still charging. And eventually, it'll reach its limitations, and it'll all level out. These numbers might be the level numbers right now, because I allowed it to run all night long, but nonetheless, it's still running a load. It's still maintaining the surplus of voltage, And so it shows the efficiency of that generator, that signal generator, is incredibly efficient. From a 5 point whatever volt input to over 10.35 on one and 5.51 on two others and 5.50 on the battery bank itself. And so even when I shut the system off and those circuits stop demanding power from that battery, that battery will have a rebound effect, and it'll come up to whatever its highest charge is that it's already got in it right now. You see what I mean?
I do.
It's incredible efficiency. And this is what I'm trying to show people, because I know that we can achieve it in all of our machinery and be able to, you know, save the planet, if that's what you want to call it. Save on fuel, save on resources, basically use everything to its maximum efficiency so you're not wasting nothing. Nature doesn't waste anything, so why should we? That's the way I look at it. That's what the mad science show is all about. And to get you out from underneath the thumb of the fuel industry, the coal industry, get you out from underneath the fuel or the electrical industries or whatever. And if you want to get off the grid, you have the knowledge right now to do it. Stephen posted one of my latest videos in there, how far it is, for anybody who hasn't had an opportunity to go take a look at that. You'll get a general idea of what it is that I'm talking about as far as my project that I got going on. I should be, within the next day or so, hopefully putting another video out on the same thing. It'll be How Far 3, and I'm going to continue to do that to show people at different frequency ranges what the advantages and disadvantages of running power at the most efficient possible manner. Right now, like I said, I've kicked it all the way down to 50 hertz with a square wave, and I'm getting those kind of results, because at a slower rate, if you understand the magnetic field, you want the magnetic field to expand fully. That'll give you your full amount of pressure. You want it to be able to collapse fully before you pulse the next wave. That'll give you the most amount of current. So that's why pretty much the standard model is at between 50 to 60 hertz that we run things. However, if you want to move the energy faster, you can ramp it up higher. But there's a trade-off in how you use different types of energies right now, at different types of frequencies. Right now, 50 hertz is giving me the extra power that I need to charge a lead acid battery that I drained down, you know, with electric motor. I just left the electric motor connected to it until the battery wouldn't run the motor anymore, and then a little bit after that to drain it down as far as I can get it, and stuck it to the system, and now it's charging itself back up with the 5 volt input that started off with. So not only is it charging the battery, but it's charging the capacitors, the whole entire circuit. Everything's running off of that 5 volt. So you're pulsing a microwave oven transformer and doing all that charging using the voltage instead of high current. You're using the voltage to do all the work. And there you go. That's a sample of it. Any thoughts?
Well, I follow it. Makes sense in my mind.
Well, with all this, I'm going to be building a generator for a friend, and I'm not only going to make it look really nice, but it's going to be super efficient, and I'm going to show him what, because he's already built a generator of his own, and I'm going to show him what he could actually do with the power that he's got available, because all these generators that we're talking about, even the standard generator right off the shelf has more capabilities than that generator is used for. When you're running that generator, you're not getting, if you're running on a heavy load, you're not getting the maximum amount of power that that generator is capable of doing. I'm here to show you how to do that, how to get the maximum amount of power that that generator is capable of, without putting that generator under a load, without putting it under a heavy enough load that it's actually going to cause heat to back up in the system or make it draw too many amps or whatever, that you can get that generator to run so efficient that you're going to save on fuel, you're going to make that generator be able to last a lot longer than it would have otherwise, being abused the way that we doing the conventional method, moving that energy away and getting the maximum bang for your buck, so to speak.
I got a question about that.
Yeah.
How does that apply to, say, like a 12-volt battery you're charging off of a solar panel or some technology, and then, you know, you're running an inverter? How would you utilize this 5 volts and this frequency in a system that's just your backup, solar system?
Same thing. You take the energy off of that solar panel, and normally it's running through a charge controller, which is there to protect your batteries, but when you get on the side where you're actually draining the power off of the batteries, where the problem comes is you're asking too much of those batteries. You're demanding too much from them, so the batteries will start getting hot, which in that turn will start off-gassing hydrogen, and eventually your batteries will fail. Well, if you put a buffer between your inverters, such as a capacitor bank, that'll make it so that your capacitors are absorbing the demand for power, so your batteries are basically there to hold a steady charge at the capacitor, so that you're not taxing the batteries like you would be if you had the inverter connected directly to the battery. So by using capacitor technology as a buffer between your battery and the load, which is the inverter at that point, then you don't make that battery have to work harder. So you got a buffer of normal capacitors, DC capacitors, and then from that point go into super capacitor technology, because two of them work slightly different, but they both store a lot of power. And then you run your inverters off of the super capacitors, and that will take that load off of your battery. Your battery is not designed to charge and discharge rapidly like the capacitors and supercapacitors. So your supercapacitors, they will absorb all that load so that your batteries stay cool and they don't have to work so hard. And then on the opposite side of your inverter, you do the same exact thing, so that now your inverter is not taxed hard. Because once you start putting that inverter under a heavy load, then that's when your inverter won't be able to keep up with demand. So if you use that system both between the battery as a buffer and between the load and the inverter as a buffer, then those systems will be maximized all the way down the line. You see what I mean?
Well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense from the DC side, and having the capacitors on that side with the battery. But after the inverter, how would you make sure the math was correct so that, or would you need? I don't really understand
AC capacitors.
How the path was on the AC side.
AC capacitors, they're storage banks. You got regular run style, and you got start capacitors. And if you're pulling the voltage off, like I'm talking about, you can use these as a buffer between that inverter, so that inverter doesn't happen to carry the entire load. Like if you got,
I've seen some 120 volt AC motor capacitors before.
Yep.
What kind of microfarads would you be looking for on that, or would it matter? You just want some kind of buffer in there.
Well, the microfarad is going to be basically the equivalence of the storage capacity of how, if the more farads you got, the more storage you got involved. And modern day supercapacitors, they have a lot of storage. They don't like to be charged with current, as far as DC batteries or DC capacitors go. But AC capacitors are a little bit more tolerable to that. And there are all kinds of capacitors out there that basically, like for example, some of these electric motors won't even run, won't even start if they don't have a capacitor in between there, because the capacitor is actually slowing that energy down and making it so that that electric motor can actually function. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
But this 12 volt, 45 amp max, 400 watt inverters that I've got here in my hand, these doggone things are capable of a lot more, and if they're not taxed hard, then they won't burn up. That's the whole thing. You keep these things cool and they'll never burn up. But if you take that energy off of that and put a buffer in between there, you can get more use out of that doggone inverter than you would have otherwise. And by storing the energy, you end up with a surplus of power available that then in turn your load is running off of that. So the folks that's figured this out so far, if you go up and look out supercapacitors out there on YouTube, you'll find people who had put capacitor banks in between as a buffer between that and their inverters, and their inverters run cooler and their batteries run cooler. Everything's working fine because there's not sudden surges of power. It maintains a steady frequency up into that thing, and there's a whole lot of benefits to capacitor technology, and that technology is getting better by the day. So with that said, we're down to the wire there, Ted. We got like 4 minutes left. You got any last words of wisdom?
Words of wisdom? I'm just a young man, dude. I'm just thinking myself, and I appreciate you getting on the radio every morning teaching people about mad science. I always enjoy it. And just hopeful that people will start, sharing more of the projects they're working on. We all know people are working on projects. Just be nice to all get in touch with each other and share a little bit more just in the world. I think that, with the way you're on that Twitch, and I've seen people get on that BitChute and some other new video platforms, I think that's cool.
Yeah.
Because sometimes YouTube's a little bit mean. People are kind of mean on there. What I mean?
So basically, if people wanna try to, get other researchers, send them over and I'll show them what I'm doing. I'll explain it to them why I'm using Twitch. I mean, it's helpful because I can actually communicate real time with people that are interested in the projects, and other people who have their own lab can do the same thing. We can have virtual labs live for a radio broadcast or, conventions that we want to have together, and basically get together and talk about all these alternative energies and how to do it.
Absolutely.
All right, so folks, that's the Mad Science Show for today. I hope you like it. I'll have to edit out one bleep word there, Ted.
I'm sorry, it's not my fault. I slipped up.
It's all right, man. It happens. We're only human. So I'll get that up out of there and then upload the podcast because today's show is pretty informative. I'd like to try to throw it on the auto DJ if I got space up there as well. So with that said, thanks a lot, Ted. It's been enjoyable once again. And everybody out there, peace and love.
That stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one hand.
Ooh.
One hand.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one hand.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this? You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life. It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back. Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before. Thank you.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.